Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Jennifer Fratchie. She's in town to perform the Schumann Violin Concerto with the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia. Albert Stamm examines support systems for newly graduated fine artists. We look ahead to Antigone, a new work from the Rebecca Davis Dance Company featuring a multinational cast of dancers. Jason Pfeiffer's at the Walnut Street Theatre for Trying, the true story of Philadelphia icon Frances Biddle. And in our regular look inside the Culture File section at gophila.com, Susan Lewis visits the Rosenbach Museum and Library. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Violinist Jennifer Fratchie is equally at home in classical repertoire as well as with works by 20th and 21st century composers. Despite now being in her 30s, she's found it difficult to lose the moniker of Rising Star, since first described thus by Andre Previn in 1992 at the Caramour International Music Festival. This despite 7 CDs to her credit and a rich resume of performances with many well-known orchestras and collaborators. Jennifer Fratchie is in Philadelphia for 2 performances with the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia. We met after rehearsals at the Kimmel Center yesterday, where I first asked her whether she was comfortable with still being referred to as a wunderkind.
Well, actually, I was never a wunderkind, and of course now that I'm in my 30s, it seems ridiculous. And it's something that I've kind of puzzled over. I've even noticed recently that, you know, when I read reviews and papers, I read the New York Times every day and I look at the artist reviews, and I notice, for example, someone like Josh Bell, who's very established. He's not called a rising star, of course. He rose, you know, a long time ago, but he is young, but he's referred to as the young artist, Joshua Bell. And of course, he's, you know, several years older than I am.
It's so interesting you make that point, because I actually made the same point to him about 2 years ago, and he said, oh, I just ignore it. It's just much, much better for my mental health if I just ignore the fact they call me the young or the bright young thing, you know?
Right, right. So it's just, for me, it's a point of curiosity. It doesn't either bother me or give me pleasure. I would agree with Josh that's something that I don't pay attention to. But I do kind of find it funny that, you know, that's something that people are fixated on. But I mean, I think in terms of, on the one hand, there's the word young, which, and of course, it's all relative. And particularly in the classical world, amongst violinists, there are always young prodigies who are very young. And in comparison, of course, I'm quite old. You know, I'm no 8-year-old or no 15-year-old. So but in terms of the rising thing, there are, you know, I'm someone whose career is still developing. And so I think that's probably where that comes from. And when I go to communities, most often, or I'd say almost always, people have not heard of me. And you know, I play with orchestras, and people come up to me and say, you know, who are you? You know, I love the way you play, but I've never heard of you. So I think that's probably where that comes from, is because my name's not a recognized name.
You've managed to mix in both your performances and in your recording older classical music and music from the 20th and 21st centuries. Tell me about your interest in and your relationships with the various composers whose works you've performed and recorded.
Well, I'd say wide-ranging in my tastes, and I'd say, for example, that my favorite composer of all is Bach, someone I haven't recorded. Actually, I don't get to perform Bach that often, but he's really a bedrock for me. But, you know, moving forward several centuries, I love the music of the 20th and 21st century, as you pointed out, and it's interesting to me how the classical music, I'd say, of different time periods hold different levels of interest for different audiences, which is to say that if I'm going to play for a younger audience, often the classical era, for example, of Mozart, Schubert, speaks less to them because it's of such a different era and so removed from their experience that they might think, oh, this is pretty music and, you know, it will appeal to some. Whereas contemporary music will very much be openly accepted by young audiences, which is interesting because when you go before a traditional audience, often traditional concert-going audience will often be resistant to very contemporary music. And so and often an older audience, you know, the over 60 crowd, even the over 50 crowd, will cotton much more to the Brahms and the Tchaikovsky and, you know, maybe Mahler part of what interests me about playing all these different periods of music is that I find that it all appeals to me, and all of it appeals to, you know, there are people out there who love it all. But I'm reaching a lot of different people that way, I think, because there are different audiences for different kinds of music.
Jennifer Fratschi, she performs the Schumann Violin Concerto in an all-Schumann program with the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia tomorrow afternoon at 2:30 and on Monday evening at 7:30 at the Kimmel Center's Perelman Theatre. The image of the starving artist isn't just a cliché, it's often very true. And having talent doesn't necessarily translate into a successful career in painting, drawing or sculpture. Yet more than in other conventional professions, the obstacles to carving out a career as a visual artist can be overwhelming. So, what programs are out there to help transform the young creator with paint-splattered coveralls into the professional, that's to say, paid, working artist? Creatively Speaking's Albert Stumm reports on organizations that are trying to make starving Philadelphia artists just a little less hungry.
There are three things artists need to know to become a success: how to meet people in the art world, how to handle themselves and the money they do make, and how to legally protect their body of work. Among others, three Philadelphia institutions tend to those needs and guide professional artists through the hazards of a difficult trade. Jeffrey Carr, Dean of Academic Affairs at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, admits that he has a partial view on how to conquer the task of networking, but he says a degree from an art school is necessary to a successful career in the arts. In addition to teaching artistic technique and execution, the Academy usually offers its students their first opportunity to take their work out of the studio and show it in a gallery setting. The annual student exhibition helps students make contacts that hopefully will lead to sales. Also, the Academy has developed relationships with galleries throughout the city. Students aren't usually placed with a gallery, but an introduction at least gets them a foot in the door. Students and alumni also are privy to seminars by working artists and educators on how to maneuver in the art world. Because, as Carr points out, there are very few artists making a decent living without a day job. To that end, the Academy offers career placement services, instructs students on the teaching application and interview process, and prepares them for what they can reasonably expect from a job at an art school or community group. The Center for Emerging Visual Artists is another organization that helps the professional development of Philadelphia artists. Founded in 1984 as the Creative Artists Network, the center is a nonprofit foundation that helps a rotating roster of about 25 artist fellows to become professional artists through a 2-year development program. The program partners fellows with artist mentors, hosts center-sponsored exhibitions throughout the city, and conducts seminars on everything from the business side of the art world to preparing taxes and planning for retirement. Center President and CEO Maida Malone says that without these services, many artists would flounder. The center's financial seminars extend past the 2-year fellowship program to include public workshops as well. Malone says it's silly to think that without help from organizations like the center, artists should be able to succeed based on talent alone. Once artists have received training and begun their professional careers, a host of legal questions can arise, from copyright issues and landlord disputes to contract negotiations with galleries. Since many emerging artists lack the resources to pay for a lawyer, the nonprofit Philadelphia Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts provides a legal hotline and a referral service. Most law firms perform pro bono work, and PVLA partners artists who have legal questions with one of about 500 lawyers throughout the city. Dana Brazier, PVLA's Associate Director and Director of Legal Services, says the nonprofit does a lot of translating from legalese to layman's terms. As Philadelphia's art scene expands and the city's art schools continue to turn out more graduates, each local artist becomes one of an ever-growing creative population. These services not only help individual artists succeed, but combined support of the artistic community will ensure that at least some artists succeed in Philadelphia, possibly preventing a creative brain drain by encouraging these artists to stay in the city. Eventually, this collaborative effort may help the city further define itself as an arts destination, independent of, and out of the shadow of, New York.
Creatively Speaking's Albert Stumm. The story of Antigone is one of Greek dramatist Sophocles' most well-known tragedies. Oedipus, Antigone's father, has taken off after discovering that he has killed his father, married his mother, and is both father and brother to his children, and his two sons, Eteocles and Polynices, have agreed to share his throne. But when Eteocles refuses to share power, the brothers battle to their deaths. Antigone's uncle, Creon, becomes king and orders that Eteocles be buried in honor and Polynices' body be left to rot. Antigone's attempts to give her shamed brother the proper burial she promised him lead to arrests, recriminations, and, like any good tragedy, deaths all around. But the strong-willed Antigone makes sure she at least dies by her own hand instead of at the hand of her uncle, King Creon. Dysfunctional families have captured our imagination through the ages, but the story of Antigone also reminds us that the choices we make, however noble, can have enduring and tragic consequences. Struck by the drama of the strong-willed Antigone, 24-year-old dancer, choreographer and entrepreneur Rebecca Davis decided to use this story for the premiere of her new dance company because in some ways it parallels her own struggles.
The artistic community is asking me to prove myself as an artist.
Davis is sitting cross-legged, her thin arms fall elegantly over her knees, dressed in dancer's leotards. She looks surprisingly relaxed, considering her company's impending debut is fast approaching. In the next room, a corps of dancers rehearse Davis's modern ballet, Antigone. Davis has gathered dancers from both the US and Russia, where she studied on a Fulbright scholarship, and used this time to create the beginnings of her own Antigone. But first things first.
It all started with a business plan. It started with the formation of the Rebecca Davis Dance Company, and then after the groundwork was laid, I had to determine how I could make people in Philadelphia aware of the company, and particularly with the challenge of trying to bring a new medium of the performing arts to Philadelphia, dance theater. And I spent a lot of time thinking about the best way to kind of showcase dance theater as an initial splash, and that led me to Antigone.
But what does a 24-year-old talented artist want with a business plan? Davis knew this would be the way to create longevity for her artistic vision. The Vancouver native came to Philadelphia because Temple University was one of the few places she could study both business and dance. Her plan for the Rebecca Davis Dance Company won the Fox School of Business's Business Plan Competition. With the prize money and guidance from the academic, business and arts communities, she registered the company as a non-profit organization where she could combine her missions to teach dance, create new professional dances, and make Philadelphia a dance center on par with New York City and Moscow. The business end was taken care of. Now she could focus on creating, and in St. Petersburg she found fertile soil. Creating an original ballet starts with a libretto, usually a word associated with opera. Davis explains what it means in dance.
A libretto is a screenplay for a ballet. So, for example, even though I had read multiple versions of the Sophoclean text, when I go to make that a ballet, I have to create different scenes, I have to completely mix up the order to make it work for movement. And then that becomes almost like the business plan for the ballet. Then it goes into implementation.
She's laughing, but Davis has a lot of hard work behind her and ahead of her, too. As part of a new generation of professional dancers, she knew she needed to connect with a new generation of dance audiences and decided to break from the traditions of classical ballet. Antigone is a modern ballet with a focus on dance theater, which combines movement, music, and text. Davis herself wrote the text and choreographed the ballet. She chose Antigone to create a compelling narrative in which she felt personally connected to the story.
For me, I could identify with the character of Antigone, a young girl really striving to become independent, and the question of what decision do you make when you're faced with opposing loyalties, and it's not clear which answer is right. That was something that really caught me personally.
Antigone, think of who you are. I am Antigone. I will bury my brother, regardless of the cost.
Pre-recorded dialogue is interspersed with movement, giving audiences a clear and dramatic understanding of the story, while presenting a few extra challenges for some of the dancers. Asiya Ohanessian, who plays Antigone, is a 20-year-old who has been dancing professionally in Russia for 12 years. She explains why dancing the role of this Greek heroine in Rebecca Davis's style is such a challenge.
It has some ballet-based movements, but it's all like modern styles. The hands are changed. They're not really classical.
In addition to non-classical dance techniques as Antigone, Asiya must also use her face to express emotion, effectively acting and dancing at the same time, hence the term dance theatre. But not all the dancers are simultaneously acting, as Philadelphia-based dancer Kip Martin explains.
So a lot of times if you see large ballets like Giselle and where there are a large group of people who are really acting very much, it could have a tendency to look a little hokey. And I think she wants it to not be so stylized in that way. You know, she wants to follow the conventions of the theater, but she also wants it to be kind of naturalistic.
Rebecca Davis herself is not dancing in this performance. As artistic director and administrator, she already has her hands full. In fact, she's done almost everything for this debut production but write the music. For the original composition for the ballet, she asked Timofey Buzina, a young Russian composer, to write the score. He began writing the composition after Davis gave him the libretto. He says he was glad to get a chance to write something new and innovative, yet based in the classical tradition.
She wanted to get something more, well, I would say funky. So music should make you feel good. Otherwise, there is no reason for music to exist.
So even from a timeless Greek tragedy, good feelings can emerge. This Thursday and Friday at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts, the Rebecca Davis Dance Company will launch its world premiere with the original performance of Davis's new ballet, Antigone. It's sort of a two-for-one, following two stories of strong, independent young women, Antigone and Rebecca Davis. The Walnut Street Theatre in Philadelphia not only boasts the largest subscription audience of any regional theatre company in the world, it also holds the distinction of being the oldest theatre in America, having been in continuous operation since it opened in 1809. This Tuesday, the historic Playhouse begins previews of Trying, a drama that celebrates another part of Philadelphia's rich heritage, the life of Francis Biddle. The Philadelphia native served as Attorney General under President Franklin D. Roosevelt and was the chief American judge at the Nuremberg trials after World War II. Now Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer has more on the play's creator and its director, an artist long associated with the Walnut Street Theatre.
Gaslight, that was a good one. The Voyage of the Inheritance is a fabulous play. Paxton Whitehead starred in that, he was marvellous.
On the second floor of the Walnut Street Theatre is a large lounge with walls lined by framed posters from well over 100 past productions performed on the Walnut stage.
Finian's Rainbow, that's a wonderful musical, and I love this play.
As Malcolm Black eagerly circles his way around the space, he points out some of the shows he's directed over the years. He's been at the helm of over 20 plays at the Walnut.
That's my life in art.
Malcolm Black's latest directorial engagement at the theater is the Philadelphia premiere of Trying. The show depicts the final life chapter of Judge Francis Biddle, a prominent legal mind in the United States during the mid-20th century. With many impressive political credentials associated with Biddle's career, on the surface it might be tempting to think of Trying as a political play or maybe a biodrama, but Malcolm Black resists those kind of labels and keeps it simple.
It's a play about an amazing relationship between a brilliant man who is in the last year of his life and a young woman who is at the beginning of her life.
The young woman of the story is Sarah Shore, a headstrong 25-year-old Canadian who serves as the new secretary of the equally stubborn Judge Biddle. The character of Sarah is based on Joanna McClelland Glass, the playwright of Trying. Glass assisted the 81-year-old Judge Biddle in 1967. He expected to die soon and sought to put his life in order. Speaking by phone from Chicago, the playwright remembers that as Biddle's sharp mind and health was failing him in those days, it affected his demeanor, which took its toll on her.
This is a warts and all depiction of a man who was often really quite cruel, as people often are in the last year of their lives, and there I was, the only person in the room. So it's quite a clear depiction of how difficult it was to work for him.
Soon after Biddle died in 1968, Joanna McClelland Glass wrote a one-act play that detailed her frustrations and warm memories as the judge's secretary. For years, Glass was unsatisfied with the writing, but didn't feel ready to return to it again until 1999. Even as a seasoned novelist and playwright, she admits it was a struggle to nail down how she wanted to write the play, which opened in 2004.
I hesitated about writing this at all because I kept thinking, you know, it would really be in an ideal world. I would write about Francis Biddle at the height of his powers, but I didn't know him then. And finally, I could really only write about what I knew in the final year.
In today's literary world, there's a debate about the nature of autobiographies and whether or not an author has the liberty to embellish and even fabricate details under the label nonfiction. While Trying might be described as semi-autobiographical, Joanna McClellan Glass makes no claim of complete accuracy. She explains that playwriting is much different than writing a book, as a play has many logistical constraints.
The actual construction of the play, that really takes precedence over other stuff. You have to make the play. You have to make certain things happen in certain places, and then you have an intermission, and then you have to make certain things happen. And sometimes the experience of your life does not fit into that, and you have to fudge things a bit.
Even though fact might not always take precedence in Trying, the play nonetheless provides a unique perspective of Glass's life for those close to her, including Malcolm Black, who's directed work by the playwright before.
I know Joanna quite well, but by the time that, you know, I got to know her, this was all in the past. And I didn't know anything about this experience that she had with Biddle, so I was fascinated by that.
According to Joanna McClellan Glass, members of the Biddle family also seem fascinated and touched by the play. She says that in the years since her employment with the judge in the late 60s, she's kept in close contact with some of the family members, many of whom still live in the Philadelphia area. Prior to a dress rehearsal performance, this week the Walnut Street Theater is hosting a reception and reunion for the local Biddles, giving the family an opportunity to see the hometown production about their esteemed relative.
Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer. Now it's time for our regular dip into the Culture File section at gophila.com. This week, Creatively Speaking, Susan Lewis takes us on a visit to the Rosenbach Museum and Library.
In the middle of a quietly genteel residential block, a short walk from Rittenhouse Square, sits a repository of literary and art treasures known as the Rosenbach. Housed in the former home of its founders, the Rosenbach is a museum and library of fine things. But it is also a doorway into a world of stories of lives from both the past and the present literary and art world. The museum actually occupies two adjoining townhouses on Delancey Street, one at number 2008, now called the Sendak Building, where visitors enter, and the other at 2010, where the Rosenbach brothers lived. 2008 has a sleek museum feel and a gallery with rotating exhibits, which bring together individual pieces to tell larger stories, like the exhibition of original Benjamin Franklin's Poor Richard's Almanacs, many of them hand-notated by Franklin's friend Isaac Norris, which were on display when we were there. Or like the 50th anniversary exhibit, called R is for Rosenbach, where over 150 of the nearly 350,000 objects in the collection were displayed whimsically in alphabetical order to explore unexpected connections, as Judy Gustin, curator and director of collections, explains.
In collections like this that are somewhat idiosyncratic in nature, the way a collector's mind, or a really good collector's mind, ends up working is that everything has a relationship to the next thing. If you took everything in the collection, threw it up in the air, and let it land, not literally, of course, anything that fell down next to the next thing would have a relationship to it if you're just willing to ask it to tell you what that was.
Telling stories through the association of objects continues in the family residence next door, where for the most part collections are unlabeled and tours are guided. But here, the story of the Rosenbachs begins. Arts and antiques dealer Philip and his younger brother, rare book dealer Abraham Simon Wolfe, known as the Doctor because of his PhD in English, owned the Rosenbach Company from 1903 to 1953, with shops in New York and Philadelphia. It was the rare book part of the business that made the name Rosenbach famous, as the museum's associate director, Michael Barsanti, explains.
In the United States, there was something of a fad in book collecting in the 20s and 30s. And you also had economically a situation where you had some of the great families of Europe, and of Britain in particular, who were book rich and cash poor on one side of the Atlantic. And then here in the United States, you had industrialists who were cash rich and book hungry. And Rosenbach was able to buy from people in Europe some of the real great treasures in books and manuscripts in particular, and sell them to people like Henry Folger, whose collection later became the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., the Widener family, whose collection became built as the Widener Library at Harvard.
Abraham died in 1952, and Philip in 1953, and the museum and library opened a year later. Aside from an opportunity to get a look at the first book printed in the United States, or a comic book made by a boy who would grow up to write Alice in Wonderland, or the manuscripts of Chaucer, Dickens, and Joyce, just to name a few, a tour of the residence is a visit back into the lives of the Rosenbachs and those whose lives they touched. The first floor rooms are furnished to illustrate their tastes. Think 18th century gentlemen. The upper floors house highlights of the collection, including works purchased by the brothers, as well as individual rooms devoted to more recent fans of the museum, like Maurice Sendak, who now has over 10,000 drawings on deposit, and the poet Marianne Moore, whose living room is recreated with her furniture and personal effects in a third-floor room which bears uncanny resemblance to her own. In Dr. Rosenbach's library, the walls are lined with shelves filled with beautifully bound or boxed books and manuscripts, as well as related things which you wouldn't necessarily expect. Near the manuscript of Ulysses sits a plaster death mask of its author, which made its way from Joyce's face after his 1941 death to Delancey Street by way of Hollywood, as Barsanti explains.
John Huston directed a film version of Joyce's short story, The Dead. While he was doing that, he was presented with this death mask. John Huston then gave it to his son, and his son, not wanting to display it in his own house, heard about the Rosenbach as the place that had the Ulysses manuscript and gave it to the museum on a long-term loan, where it was here for many years. Huston decided to sell it, and the person who bought it from Tony Huston eventually decided to have it on display here as well, so that Joyce can be back together with his Ulysses manuscript on our shelves. It's certainly a very accurate presentation. It's really kind of, it's a little scary looking.
It may be a little scary. It certainly is consistent with the creative, almost mischievous spirit that runs through this house, inspired perhaps by the Rosenbachs' own unique personalities and legacy.
It's sort of a haunted house that way. We have the brothers hovering around. So we do, I mean, they had such strong personalities, and their vision is expressed very clearly in the things that they chose to keep. They were both very smart, educated people, but they like to take some of the world's great treasures, and they like to have fun with them, and that's what we like to do here.
In keeping with the eclectic nature of the collection, Rosenbach reaches out to visitors in a collection of eclectic ways, as in its well-known annual Bloomsday event, when a variety of notable Philadelphians take turns at reading Joyce's work. The idea, says Judy Gustin, is to help people access the materials in ways that are fresh and new.
Some people will respond well to going to an exhibition and finding their way along and reading the labels, and some people would rather come to a gallery talk, and then some people would rather experience the arts in other ways. And for Bloomsday, for instance, it's not a surprise to people to know that Joyce's novel is difficult, so why not come and hear it the way that a lot of literature really is best heard from ancient epic on down the line? Hearing it makes it suddenly somewhat clear, particularly once you add in the music and the voices.
The museum has beautiful and rare objects and wonderful stories that go with them. Ultimately, though, the greatest strength of the Rosenbach today is the same as it was when its founders were alive, the ability to make human connections with people, with the artists and writers it has drawn into its world, from Lewis Carroll, Dickens, and Joyce, to Sendak and Marianne Moore, and with those of us who, like invited guests, step through its mahogany townhouse doors.
Creatively speaking, Susan Lewis. More information on the Rosenbach Museum and Library is available at the Culture File section of gofilla.com. And that's it for now. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Rich Duran, Thomas Miller, and Paula Butler. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.